Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. We have four appeals to hear this morning. Counsel, we're familiar with your cases. We've read your briefs, the authority cited in your briefs, and at least portions of the record. So you have limited time this morning. Feel free to go straight to the heart of your argument. Whatever you've addressed in your brief that you're not able to discuss with us this morning will, of course, still be preserved. We're probably going to have some questions. In the event that the red light shines, and we do ask that you be mindful of the clock and when your time is about to expire. But in the event that, that your time expires and you're answering a question from the court, please feel free to finish your answer. If you have rebuttal time, you won't eat into it, but do be mindful of the clock. Our first case this morning is United States versus Pate. Mr. Samuel.
Good morning, Your Honor. I assume my audio is okay.
We can hear you fine.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Don Samuel. I practice law here in Atlanta. And I was not trial counsel for Ms. Pate, but I was, I did appear at sentencing and now her appellate counsel. Ms. Pate was the owner of a company known as Southern Respiratory, which was a durable medical equipment supplier. As far as this case is concerned, primarily the company supplied wheelchairs to patients. These wheelchairs were always required or requested by a treating physician. The treating physician would designate the type of wheelchair that was needed, as well as the any accessories such as brakes or extra padding or something like that. Some wheelchairs are considerably more expensive than others. For example, for someone who's very heavy, they need a heavier weight wheelchair. The allegations in this case are that Ms. Pate would order from Medicare the correct wheelchair, but bill Medicare, excuse me, would supply the correct kind of wheelchair, but would bill Medicare for a more expensive wheelchair or more accessories, thus increasing substantially her profit. She was indicted in the Southern District of Georgia and charged with healthcare fraud. And because of the use of forged doctor signatures when the company was audited, she was also charged with aggravated identity theft. We've raised a number of issues dealing with both the trial evidence issues as well as two sentencing issues. The first issue I'd like to address with the court's permission involves the exclusion of a document that the defense considered to be essential evidence in challenging the credibility of the key prosecution witness, a woman named Ms. Merck Harrison.
Counsel, let me ask you this. The letter was read in its entirety to the jury, was it not?
It was. It was.
And, trial counsel was allowed to cross-examine the witness in addition to reading the letter, correct?
Yes, on page 450 of the record, the trial counsel requested that the court allow the document to be introduced in evidence.
All right. So what we're talking about here is simply, it is not excluding the evidence, but simply the form in which it was admitted. It was read verbatim.
It was read verbatim.
And the witness was cross-examined at some length about it.
Well, a page or two, yes. It's on page 450 of the record.
At
yes.
some length, yes. But my point is, the only thing that the district court didn't allow, the judge didn't allow counsel to do is put the letter into evidence so it would go back with the jury.
Your Honor, it was not allowed to be published to the jury. The jury was not allowed to see the document. And as you say, the court also prohibited the document from being introduced in evidence and going out with the jury during deliberations for their consideration.
So why is that harmful?
Well, this wasn't some insignificant document, Your Honor. This was the most important part of the cross-examination of this witness, whose testimony was really devastating, to put it bluntly, to the defendant. She was the one who was actually forging all the documents. They called it the arts and crafts process of forging doctor's signatures. So,
well, she wasn't the only one who forged doctor's signatures.
She was the principal one. And I think even the government in its brief acknowledges that she was a key witness for the government. And this document established a motive for why she would lie and why she would have pinned the blame on Ms. Pate, because she was attempting to start a new company. She minimized it during her testimony. This was just a dream I had of starting a new company. But in fact, she and another employee were starting a new company, were making allegations against Ms. Pate, trying to encourage doctors to use her service, her new company that she was going to form, even had a name.
All of which the jury was fully informed of. Argument, too. Right.
Trial counsel was permitted to read it one time to the jury over objection from the government. But unlike all the government, you know, when the government wants to introduce evidence, they're not told, well, you can read it, but you can't put a document in. They weren't.
Well, so you don't know that that's always the rule, counsel. I mean, what we've got here is the letter was read. I assume he read it at his own pace to the jury.
Can't tell from a transcript.
Cross-examined the witness about it. He was given a full and fair opportunity to do that. And then he argued in closing argument. It's not a complicated multi-page letter, is it? How many pages is it?
It's really quite short, Your Honor. It's one paragraph.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So there's no reason to believe the jury wasn't fully aware of
it. Your Honor, I can't argue with you the fact that the jury heard the contents of the letter, but the government also can't argue that the document was a critical document to impeach the witness. To have it out with the jury, to be able to display it to the jury, to show it to the jury.
I'm having a hard time how it really even does that. I mean, it certainly suggests, makes clear that the letter writer wanted to start a new business.
Correct.
But as I understand it, the business never really got off the ground, right?
Well, that would have been subsequent to the writing of the letter. The point,
of course,
the significant,
but that's what ended up happening, and the jury was told that that's what she wanted to do. She admitted there's no real dispute that that's what she wanted to do, right?
Well, she minimized it. She said that we had a dream of starting a new company, but this showed that it was actually well in progress, and that's why she was going to test. That's why this was the theory of the.
How does it show that?
Because
it says is I'm leaving secondary to unethical business and billing practices, which have been brought to the attention of the Office of Inspector General. She says I'll no longer be working at Southern Respiratory.
That's right, it's on page 4.
I look forward to working with you in the near future with Delta Medical Equipment.
Right.
That's it.
Right, the theory of the defense was that she was trying to steal the business from Southern Respiratory, from Ms.
And the jury heard it.
Well, then we're back to the harmless error issue as opposed to whether it's relevant. It's clearly relevant, it's clearly, you know, it wasn't hearsay, which was the government's theory at trial, that it should be excluded entirely, that it shouldn't be used. And the judge kind of compromised and said, well, I think it is hearsay, though it clearly wasn't. It wasn't offered.
Why wasn't it? I mean, it's being introduced to prove the truth of the matter asserted that she was leaving to start a new business venture.
Well, the first sentence is the accusation that Ms. Pate was engaged in unethical business practices, which obviously was not the intention of the defense to present that as a truthful matter, the exact opposite of what the defense. It was shown, the document was being used to
prove. I thought your theory was the reason you needed this letter was to show her motive, and that is that she was well underway and starting a new business. So it seems to me that the portion of the letter that goes to that is the last part of it. I look forward to working with you in the near future with Delta Medical Equipment. And so what you're saying is you were introducing it to prove the truth of the matter asserted.
We're not trying to prove that she's looking forward. We're trying to prove that this was in progress, that she was making false accusations against Ms. Pei. That was the theory. She's making false accusations against Ms. Pei. You should stop doing business with her and come to do business with me. And that was her reason for them. And that is all part and parcel of what the defense theory was her motive to lie. And it's critical under the Sixth Amendment to be able to confront the witness.
I don't know if we have any other questions about that issue. If you want to stay on it, you certainly can.
No.
And if you have another issue you wanted to get to, you only have a little time left.
I understand that. Your Honor, we have raised the issue of the impropriety of introducing evidence of how Ms. Pate spent money. This is an issue that arises frequently in fraud cases. This was a subject of motions in limine ahead of trial.
That seems to be classic motive evidence to me.
Well, but that would be, it's not motive evidence unless it shows that unless the court were going to say that in every single case involving an economic crime, the government can introduce evidence that the defendant bought a watch or the defendant bought a necklace. There's no proof that
it's counsel, it's the Rolex exception to that rule.
I haven't seen that in rule in the 400 series of the evidence rules, Your
Honor. It's not that they bought a watch, it's that they bought a very expensive watch, two very expensive diamonds, a car, paying cash, and so forth and so on.
Well, I understand, Your Honor, but still that this court and the Bradley decision, which we've cited, have said that unless it is relevant to the actual crime that was committed, it's not admissible to prove, either the motive. Everybody spends money. She owned this company. She made a lot of money legitimately. And to try to exploit the fact that she buys jewelry or buys an ATV for her son's birthday is hardly evidence that she committed the crime. Your Honor, can I raise one more issue that I
want to- You got a minute.
I got a minute. We have raised two sentencing issues, sophisticated means, and which we've briefed at length, and I don't want to re-argue that.
Okay.
I do want to point out, though, very much, Judge Carnes, of course, 16 years ago, wrote a concurring opinion in which she said, if the court were to indicate that the sentence wouldn't be any different regardless of the guideline calculation, then it might be harmless error.
Yep.
I did not point that out in my brief. The government didn't raise that in its brief. But Judge Hall did make that observation. We would ask the court, and I'll discuss this a little bit in rebuttal, not to invoke that rule here because of the dramatic difference. If we were to win the two guideline issues, the dramatic difference in the guideline calculation, and we would ask the court not to invoke that harmless error doctrine in this case. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Samuel. You've saved a few minutes for rebuttal. Is it Davids?
Davids,
Your Honor. Davids.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Justin Davids, and I'm an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of Georgia, and I represent the appellee, the United States of America. Your Honors, I'll start with the wealth evidence issue just briefly. And I think that in this case, I think that the 11th Circuit's case law is pretty clear that wealth evidence is evaluated under rules 401 and 403, and it's a balancing test. And in the lower court, the defendant agreed with this. Their arguments below focused on, especially on the 403 balancing. On appeal, they cite the Sixth Circuit test, which involves showing that the money somehow actually derived from the fraudulent conduct before it can be entered in as wealth evidence. The government believes that the 11th Circuit's approach is more flexible. It's more consistent with Rule 403B evidence, which is the exclusion under 403 is a pretty rare event. evidence is presumed to be admissible. And the 11th Circuit's precedent provides district courts that flexibility in evaluating the specific facts of a case and determining whether it's appropriate to enter it. And so in this case, the wealth evidence was relevant for several reasons. It was relevant and probative for motive in this case. The defendant was the person that had the incentive to maximize profit for Southern Respiratory. They personally benefited from that profit. It rebuts one of the defenses in this case, which was that other people were responsible for the fraud, not the defendant, because again, it shows that she personally benefited from the proceeds of this fraud. It's somewhat intrinsic to the crime in that it completes the story. It shows where the money ended up going. I would say that even if the court were to consider something like the Sixth Circuit's approach, which again, I think is a little too restrictive, here, we sort of still have that. The evidence showed that almost $1 million was paid by Medicare for these K7, these heavy duty wheelchairs alone to Southern Respiratory. And it went into the Southern Respiratory bank account. And the money to purchase these the jewelry and the ATV came out of the Southern Respiratory bank account. So in that sense, once we're dealing with commingled funds, it's a little more unreasonable to say that you have to show that that dollar actually came from the fraud. Your Honors, I think that, and then finally we have the harmless error analysis that, even if it were improperly admitted, that the evidence here of the defendant's involvement in Medicare fraud was fairly overwhelming, and it did not have a substantial impact on the jury's verdict. To go to the sentencing issues, and I'm thankful that Mr. Samuel brought this up, because I agree, I had missed the issue of the district court acknowledging that at the end of sentencing, that based upon the 3553A factors, it would have imposed the same sentence, even if it hadn't imposed the sentencing guidelines enhancements. And I apologize for missing that issue, but it does go to this court's assumed harmless error analysis. And as part of that analysis, the court will still affirm a judgment if the sentence remains substantively reasonable. And, appellant asked the court to essentially, not apply that analysis in the sense that he says that there's a dramatic difference. And I think that really goes to the reasonableness of the sentence. And that's under an abuse of discretion standard. Judge Hall, it's around, I believe, page 148 to 150 of the sentencing transcript, goes through his 3553A analysis, explaining why he would impose the same sentence. And, I think that it's, even if those sentencing enhancements did not apply, that the court could still consider the conduct related to those sentences, those sentencing enhancements to vary above the guideline range. And in this case, it'd be about, if neither one of the sentencing enhancements were applied, it'd be a 19-month upward variance. If one of the sentencing enhancements were applied, the sentence would be at the high end of that guideline range. It'd still be a guideline range sentence, but it'd be at the high end. And so, you know, some of those 3553A factors were that the defendant personally involved herself in the fraudulent conduct by going into this Brightree system, changing the wheelchair orders, changing equipment orders, and then in order to avoid being caught when these Medicare submitted audits requests to her, she involved her employees. She instructed them to assist her with the fraud. She instructed them to forge doctor signatures. She engaged in some forgery herself. And the court also believed that, you know, Medicare is a program that's meant to help older citizens. And so stealing from this program is a particularly egregious act that cannot be tolerated.
Mr. Davids, with regard to the sophisticated means enhancement, can you tell me how her use of the computer was sophisticated?
Your Honor, the use of the computer itself, she had to understand how the Brightree system operates and how Medicare accepts those submissions in order to know how to change it in a way that would cause Medicare to reimburse her for costs. I think that if we're talking about the enhancement itself, I think we have to look though at the totality of the circumstances. It's not just her use of the computer that results in the sophisticated means enhancement in this case.
I agree that we do have to look at the totality, but you know, the listed factors are use of the computer, use of alter ego companies, holding companies, things like that. And I don't see this here. Here she conscripted her employees to assist her with covering up the fraud, but I'm not sure that rises to the level of sophistication.
Well, I think in U.S. v. Mangiano, the 11th Circuit has described that it's repetitive coordinated conduct to perpetrate and conceal fraud that supports the enhancement. And you know, interestingly, in Mangiano, the 11th Circuit quoted the district court with some approval, and the district court has described that Medicare fraud is sophisticated by its very nature because the participants have to do numerous things just right. And so here, it was not only the use of the computer, but it was then the repetitive coordinated conduct with her employees over the course of 2+ years, which indicates some sophistication to avoid detection, to avoid being through these Medicare audits, being detected of the fraud. You know, that supports the enhancement. You know, I think we go—
Is there also some concealment?
Yes, the use of the doctor's signatures goes to part of the concealment.
I thought there was some shredding of evidence too.
There was some shredding of evidence too, that as the appellant mentions, this arts and craft box was essentially a box where they kept scraps, and some of them were eventually, you know, shredded, and others were, you know, hadn't been yet shredded, but were anticipated to be done later, is my understanding.
Is this a finding of fact?
Yes, it's a clear error standard. And so, and to just briefly address some of the cases that appellant cites, the Middle District of Alabama case, Hulse, cites an 11th Circuit case, Mendez. And I believe that at best for appellant, they're in a posit. At worst for appellant, they actually support the government's position. So in Mendez, the court there observed that in each case where the application of the sophisticated means enhancement had been upheld, the defendant used false identities to conceal his participation or to execute and conceal the fraudulent transactions. Well, that's what we have here. We have the defendant using false identities to help conceal the fraud. So Mendez really supports the enhancement being used in this case. Hulse, the district court actually found that there were no false identities used. That was one of the reasons it felt that the sophisticated means enhancement shouldn't apply, that the defendants in that case were getting fraudulent loans and they were using their own names. It was going into bank accounts with their own names. And the district court also found that there was no concealment. And so factually, Hulse demonstrates a very different case than what we have here. So based on that, I think that even if we don't go into the reasonableness of the sentence, or if the court were to find that otherwise the sentence were unreasonable, that the sentence enhancement was, there was no clear error in applying the sentencing enhancement.
Counsel, why did the judge let defense counsel read the letter to the jury and cross-examine the witness about it, but wouldn't allow the letter to go to the jury?
I think that the court had some concerns about the hearsay aspect of the letter, particularly because it was not a letter written by the witness.
That doesn't explain why you would let counsel read the letter in full to the jury, hearsay and all, if any.
Your Honor, I agree. I think that the trial judge has incredible discretion in allowing defendants to engage in effective cross-examination. Defendants are not entitled to cross-examination by any means they want to, but the district court has broad discretion in allowing district courts to allow defendants to engage in effective cross-examination.
Seems to me, Mr. Samuel had pretty good argument that it actually wasn't hearsay. It wasn't being introduced to prove the truth of the matter asserted, because it wasn't being introduced to prove that she looked forward to working with her former customers at the new business. It was actually to show something else.
Sure. I think there are two aspects of the letter. There's the aspect of the letter where they talk about the fraud, and of course that the defendant does not want to enter that into the evidence.
For that purpose, as right. He said, is the opposite, right?
Right, and the part of the letter that they wanted to enter in for the truth of the matter is that the witness and the writer of the letter, Kimberly Grotz, I think was her name, were going to start this business.
Mm-hmm.
That's the truth of the matter. I do think, though, that arguably the court could allow it in at least to be cross-examined.
But your better argument is harmless error.
It's harmless error. I think that it's also that, again, the court has this broad discretion on admitting evidence. And it's effective cross-examination, not effective cross-examination by any means you want.
Okay. Mr. Davids, your time is up. We appreciate your argument. Mr. Samuel, you've got 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. You know, with regard to the expenditure of money issue, you know, the government's argument is you can introduce whatever evidence you want to show that she benefited from the fraud. And of course, that's the income part of it. And so the government was able to do that by showing the amount of money that Medicare paid into the company and then eventually to her. She's the owner of the company. But why does that allow the government to introduce evidence that she bought birthday presents for her son, an ATV, or the Rolex watch, or the necklace? The point of showing—
Well, in white collar cases, lavish spending by a defendant is often introduced to prove motive.
Well,
isn't that just a common occurrence?
I don't know that it's common, and I don't know that it's right. The point, in order to show greed, right, in order to show that you're the perpetrator or the motive is that you received money. Would the court also have allowed, hypothetically, Ms. Pate to introduce evidence that she gave money to charity, that she gave money to orphanages in Africa for, you know, for orphans?
Sure. Suppose she had given $500,000 to Mother Teresa's orphanage in Calcutta. That would have been admissible.
Well, it doesn't prove anything, though. It doesn't
prove she had $500,000 and the desire to spend it.
The money's already been proven. The income is proven already. How you spend the money doesn't prove that you're the perpetrator of the offense. If now I give an examples in my brief. If you're a drug dealer and you need the money to buy drugs, then you can use it to show that you know that you're the perpetrator, that you had a motive. But whether you give the money to Mother Teresa or give the money to a jewelry store doesn't prove motive. It just shows you have access to money. That's already been proven by the receipt of the money by the company. It doesn't add anything other than prejudice the defendant by virtue of the fact that she bought a Rolex watch. I don't see how that adds to the—
Well, if you've got the receipt of the money, but to show its profit, you've got to be able to spend it. If the Dural medical goods cost $950,000, and she had taken in $1 million in funds from the customers, that's one thing. But taking in enough money to buy new cars, two diamonds, Rolex, and so forth and so on, after you've taken in the money and gotten the profit out of it, is a different thing.
I've run out of time, Judge. I'm not quite sure I understand. The receipt of the money was a given. There's no doubt she received the money. Whether she spends it on Mother Teresa or on a car doesn't change the amount.
The difference that my question sought unsuccessfully to point out is there's a difference between receiving gross proceeds of a sale of durable medical equipment, mm-hmm. having obtained a huge profit from the operation of the business because you weren't paying on the front end for the goods that you were charging for on the back end. Lavish spending shows inordinate profit, which is indicative of fraud. Not necessarily requires it, but it is indicative of it. That was my question to you. There's a question mark at the end of that.
Well, I'm well past my time, Your Honor.
No, you can take a half minute.
Okay, Your Honor, I would only respond by saying that the whether you spend money on jewelry or on Mother Teresa doesn't change the amount of money that you received. To just say that you bought a watch over the course of 2 years or an ATV, even the jeweler said this was normal expenditures for her over the years, doesn't establish that she is the perpetrator or that there was a motive for committing the crime.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Samuel. I think we have your case, and we'll move to the next one this morning.